And we're live for another episode of the Trilzerian Show. Today, I came to Julia's house to record a podcast with me and her. And then the famous Matthew Akins just so happened to walk through the door. And I thought to myself, this is too fortuitous to pass up the opportunity to interview the one and only Matt Akins. So I grabbed him against his will, put a microphone on him. And here he is. Thank you for being on the show, Matt, against your will. We appreciate you being here.
So, thanks, brother. Yeah. I appreciate it. I'm really happy to be here, you know, spending New Year's Day with friends and family. So,
fucking A.
You know, well, family. I don't have very many friends. You know?
Who needs friends when you got family? So here we are. The day after New Year's, we went out and got drunk as a skunk last night. I think all of us did at our respective places. So now we're loving on puppy dogs and drinking coffee and mimosa. And we're going to tell you some awesome stories. Usually once I get Matt started, it's just like amazing shit comes out. So I've been wanting to have him on the show for a long time, and I'm really, really excited to have him here. So, yeah, Matt, let's start with like just some background about you. Where'd you grow up? What kind of shit were you into and all that good stuff?
I was born in 1974. Grew up on the East Coast, mm-hmm. East Coast, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I was about 13, 14 years old, my parents moved us out here to Oklahoma. And, you know, I just say, you know, the year I was born because of that generation, you know, of course, Bruce Lee was huge. Mm-hmm. So, of course, that was basically my inspiration for martial arts. And went to high school out here in Oklahoma. And I really didn't even start martial arts until I actually graduated. I was about 18, 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And so, anyways, you know, my stepdad is Thai, and mm-hmm. he always tried to basically, you know, explain to us what Muay Thai was like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so, I don't know, I kind of grew up with that kind of background with the striking arts. Mm-hmm. And then when I was about 18 years old, after I graduated, my friends and I found an instructor out here, Rafael Lovato Sr. Mm-hmm. And he was teaching Jeet Kune Do at the time out of, you know, down, you know, it was really grassroots kind of project, down in the basement. He was just getting started in teaching Jeet Kune Do, and he was under Sifu Richard Bustillo out of the IMB Academy in Los Angeles. And then, yeah, that was basically my start. It was basically Jeet Kune Do. And, well, actually, it was in Aikido. Because I was watching, because I love the Steven Seagal movie Above the Law. I thought it's some of the best choreography there. Uh-huh. And so I went to an Aikido school that lasted about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I knew, dude, they were making so much fun of me over at Lovato's. You know, because all my friends from high school, we all were there. We were like the original students there.
Yeah.
And I remember the day I walked in, and one of my best friends, Brock, who's also does a lot of jiu-jitsu, every kind of martial art known to man. Mm-hmm. And he looked at Senior, and Senior's like, dude, check this out. And he put me through, like, basically the submission, the arm lock, lock flow. And I was pretty much sold. And he's like, okay, your buddy likes submissions. He likes joint locks, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he just kind of locked me up and twisted me around. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna be start training here for a while.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Very cool. Yeah.
So
that started out on this side of the world.
Yeah.
Here in Oklahoma.
Uh huh.
And then, not too long after that, you moved out to Cali, right?
Yeah. Actually, what happened was, we were, you know, under the IMB Association and under Richard Bustill. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, there was an instructorship conference, a week-long conference in Los Angeles. And we went out there, and this was probably the summer of 93. Mm-hmm. And basically, okay, these conferences,
They have, see, these dogs are loving on me. So. anyways.
You're a lovable person.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So in 93, the way they do these conferences is like they have an instructor that comes in, and each one specializes in his own martial art, mm-hmm. in each different range of as far as martial arts go. Like as far as the first day was just the Eskrima. Second day was, you know, it'd be like kickboxing. Third day would be Wing Chun. The fourth day, you know, I mean, there's a different instructor every single day specializing in their respective arts. Mm-hmm. The fourth, the last day on a Friday, I remember they brought in Jean-Jacques Machado mm-hmm. to handle the grappling portion of the curriculum.
Yeah.
And Jean-Jacques came in there with Fernando Vasconcelos. Fernando mm-hmm. Vasconcelos was, I believe, 14 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. Fernando was basically, I don't know, he was sent to live out here by his parents, and he was adopted by all the Machado brothers. And so all of the Machado brothers kind of put a lot of their energy into him. He was like their protege. Mm-hmm. And I believe at the time, Fernando would eventually go on to become the youngest person at that time in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu to win the world championships. So he was 14 years old at the time. Wow. And on the very last day, we have all these people, you know, wanting to come in and train, you know. And they would put us all on a line, and basically they're like, okay, let's see who can pass our guard without getting submitted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it was really an eye-opening experience, because here's this 14-year-old kid, and all the normal guys, like guys that were kind of small, would go up against Jean-Jacques, but all like these big, huge, muscular guys with like huge egos that don't want to be submitted, they all lined up to like train with Fernando, you know. And Fernando's like 14 years old, you know. So I was like, Jesus Christ! I mean, this poor kid. Yeah. But he played with them. He smoked them, yeah. You know. So after the training, I pulled him aside and we sat down. I bought him a Coke, and we just sat there, and I was like, wow, man, that was awesome. We're just shaking our heads, like, mm-hmm. And that was it. That was the introduction to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Mm-hmm. And then I believe in 94, like after we got home, Tony Akiqua, he was like, hey, you know, there are all these ads out in the magazines and Black Belt. The Gracie family started putting out Horian Gracie, all these ads in Kung Fu, Black Belt, and it was the Gracie and Action Tapes. And so what happened was, Tony was like, hey, why don't we all pull our money together, chip in, let's buy these tapes, and because these guys are awesome. So we did that. So mm-hmm. the tapes came in, and I remember they put a copy guard on the tape.
Bummer.
And so all these tapes are, the footage was already pretty grainy and pretty bad to begin with. Uh-huh. And but by copying them and copying the copy guard on top of it, you know, they looked even worse. Yeah. You know, and so they looked like they'd been fried in microwave. Oh my goodness. So we watched these, and we were like, you know, at the time, you know, all I wanted to do was like submissions. I was already introduced to the shoot wrestling curriculum, and I did not understand the importance of the positioning. Mm-hmm. You know, because you see all these guys taking people down, but you don't see a lot of submissions at that time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they were cool. That was our introduction to basically Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. Wow. And, you know, and just controlling positions, you know. And then mm-hmm. Hoist Gracie was in the UFC, and everything pretty much changed, you know. Yeah. Everyone was like, wow, holy mm-hmm. shit, this is amazing. This guy who's, you know, 160 pounds is beating up everybody.
And that was really, like, kind of the point when jiu-jitsu blew up in the United States, right?
Yeah,
like
that's when it blew
people
up.
People started to see, like, this is one of the most effective martial arts out there.
Yeah, it was the beginning of the end for, because at that time, you know, Jeet Kune Do was having a huge resurgence. It was in all the magazines, you know, Brandon Lee and The Crow and you know, all of that. And, you know, it was basically the beginning of Brazilian jiu-jitsu's dominance here in United States and eventually the world.
Yeah.
And so that summer, my brother and I, all of our friends, everybody over at Lovato's, mm-hmm. all like pretty much the all the students that were like the founding members of at that time it was known as Lovato's Jiu-Jitsu. It was known as Martial Arts International. And my friend Brock, you know, I don't know, they all we all separated, we all split up, and we promised each other in a couple of years we would all come back together in Los Angeles and we would do jiu-jitsu. And that lasted about 6 months.
Yeah.
We all ended up in Los Angeles.
How cool.
And what happened was I went to school at the Dallas Art Institute, and I was out there for about a year. And prior to that, we had taken another trip to Los Angeles. And at that time, my best friend and I, Justin Thomas, we had an interview with the head of production and advertising for Paramount Pictures. And because that was my love and passion was art, you know, I wanted to be a comic book artist. And you know, I just wanted to see what was out there. And during that time, that week that we were out there, my brother was scouting jiu-jitsu schools, specifically Hickson's Academy. And
Henry was?
Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah, we were trying to find it. So we were making calls all over Los Angeles. We called up the Torrance Academy. And they're basically like, oh, no, you know, we don't know any Hickson Gracie, and there's no such thing as the Hickson Gracie Academy. It doesn't exist, you know.
Oh, wow.
Because, yeah, there was a falling out in the family.
Interesting. So, and this is still when jiu-jitsu was very, like, guarded. Right, and they didn't want the masses to be able to train with these top level dudes, or is that kind of near or hearsay?
No, it wasn't, because all the schools, it was about basically making money was the bottom line, and it was basically because, I mean, these schools are not private; they're open to the public. Anybody can go in and join. It's like any other taekwondo karate school, except, you know, it actually works.
Yeah,
but, you know, you learn something that changes.
You hear that,
life.
Coach Jackson? Oh.
So, anyways, fire. No. I think that there was a falling out with, you know, not to get too deep into it, but yeah, there was kind of a falling out between Hickson and his brother, and his brother probably wanted to pull everybody to his school, and you know,
and basically not refer them to.
Yeah, basically, Hickson, the receptionists were told that, you know, hey, if you want to train jiu-jitsu, come to our academy. No other schools in jiu-jitsu are basically qualified, you know? So, anyways, we sat there, and we were, like, sitting there, like, watching, like, the Gracie action tapes, and we're like, you know, Hickson Gracie, he's a stud. He looks like, you know, the most badass of all the brothers, because we didn't know anything about the Gracie family, really, except watching the UFC. And after watching the Gracie in action tapes, you watch the UFC, you see the Gracie train, you see, like, you know, just this, you know, it's just a very inspiring feeling when you watch all the brothers, the entire family, you know, walk out, you know, the second youngest brother, and he's about to go to war. And so, but then when the camera zooms in on Hickson, you know, after Hoist had won,
right?
Everybody was sitting there. We were all sitting there. Why didn't they put Hickson in there? Why isn't he fighting? Because he just has this kind of enigma, this kind of aura.
Yeah.
You know? So even though Hoist was the champion of the UFC at the time, yeah, we scouted out the Hickson Gracie Academy. So we stayed at my aunt's in Beverly Hills, and we had heard that there was a school, the Hickson Gracie Academy, that did exist. And so that kind of fueled the flames. And
I'm going to stop you for just a second.
Yeah.
So you talked about how, like, they sent Hoist out, but really we all wanted to see Hickson fight because Hickson is the only one that had, like, a lot of muscular tone and all that stuff. He was, like, 180, 190 pounds of pure muscle, and he has, like, this aura of a fighter, like what you would expect, whereas Hoist is this little skinny 160 pound dude, and he was the one that they sent out there. Do you know, like, the thought process behind that? Like, why did they send Hoist instead of Hickson at first? Was it to see the contrast of, like, this little skinny dude applying leverage to a bigger guy, or do you think it would have been less impressive if it was, like, someone built like an athlete that was out there doing that? And maybe it would have taken away some of the clout or some of the impressiveness or whatever from those first matches.
You know, to be perfectly honest with you, this is, these are just my views, my opinion. This is just my understanding of what was going on at the time. In that, to promote the art of jiu-jitsu here in the United States, they did it very much like the way they did in Brazil with the Open Challenge. And what Jorge and Gracie was trying to do is he was trying to take his family's art and basically promote it, bottle, package, and sell it as a as a product, you know. And so in order to sell the idea of jiu-jitsu, it's at that time, if you take a look at the early UFCs, they didn't promote, it wasn't fighter versus fighter. It was, they promoted it as art versus art. So there was, like, you know, jiu-jitsu versus karate, shoot wrestling versus wrestling, and, you know, and I don't know, there was also sumo, there was some, you know, but basically it was like they wanted to prove what was the most effective art, not who was the best fighter, right? So basically they're trying to sell the idea of jiu-jitsu. So by having Hoist in there, Hoist completely sells the idea of jiu-jitsu. Because he's got the gi on, he's one of the smallest fighters competing, and you know, and he was winning. And so that sells jiu-jitsu. When you put somebody like Hickson in there, because of his charisma and because of his attitude, basically what happens is he becomes a superstar. And you don't sell jiu-jitsu, but
you sell
it
Hickson.
Becomes, you're selling basically Hickson, you know? And Hickson's not really a commodity that Horian has ever been able to control. That's the difference between Hickson and Hoist. And, and it had a lot to do with the idolization in the family, you know, because at that time, Hoist really, really looked up to his brother Horian. And, you know, and so he basically, you know, kind of would do whatever Horian said.
Whereas and he didn't have that control over Hickson.
No.
Hickson wasn't as easily incentivized or whatever.
I mean, if they had Hickson in there, it would just, it was basically, it would have been just, you know, Hickson Gracie.
The Hickson show.
It would have, it would have been the Hickson Gracie show.
You know?
But then, and that's the thing, because they would actually send Hoist to go train with Hickson. Like, Hickson was training Hoist prior to all the UFCs.
I heard that in the interview, that he was like the one that was training him for all those
So it doesn't make any sense, you know, why you wouldn't have the top guy in the family competing. Because, so, it was just basically about making money.
It was a business marketing scheme.
Absolutely.
Which makes a lot of sense, because there's such a big contrast. If you saw someone, like, skinny, and you'd be like, just kind of run-of-the-mill dude, you're like, oh, he's going to get his ass kicked by this big guy. It's what everyone thinks, you know, until, boom, he's using these techniques from this specific martial art. So it's really smart the way that they they did that.
And because
what ended up happening was Hickson went to Pride, right? Or was it Risen back then? I can't remember.
Rising,
yeah. And he just, I mean, that became the Hickson show pretty much. Like, he fucked everyone up, so.
Yeah, at that time,
I'm sorry.
Mic down. Fuck it.
Gotcha.
You need to pause.
I can edit it out later. I am a master at this now.
Master editor.
Jeez, I'm just like trailing off.
No, it's good. This is exactly what I wanted.
It's real life.
Yeah. We just wanted to get these awesome stories that you've got, you know, out to the world.
Well, okay. To understand the fighting that's going on in Japan at that time, you have to understand that in Japan, you know, pro wrestling, professional wrestling is huge. And professional wrestling in Japan is classified under two categories. They have one which is like the very showy kind of professional wrestling, which is basically a lot like Lucha Libre
or whatever.
WWE is actually, because it's very American, it's very strength, power-based, you know, huge movements. And then there's another style in Japan called the hard style, which is, you know, promotions like UWO kind of pushed. And those, if you go back and you watch those, they're actually rather incredible, because they're nothing but just pure submissions, you know, with the idea, you know, to create basically tremendous amount of like excitement. They have this idea of like the rope escape. When somebody's getting close to being submitted, if they grab the rope, you know, they let go. But yeah, they're really cool. And these days I'll show you some of those videos because they're really intense, you know. And but the thing is, I believe in the early 80s, Carl Gotch, who is basically considered by many people one of the fathers of catch wrestling, went to Japan. And between him and there were several other influences, like Victor Koga, half Japanese, half Russian sambo instructor, was also there. And so, you know, all the top professional wrestlers in Japan, eventually they left their organizations, and Masakatsu Funaki broke apart from, I believe, it was Rings Japan, and he created Pankras. And Satoru Sayama went on to create shoot wrestling, you know? And you've seen some of those videos where they're doing like those crazy, you know, like old footage that I showed you like a long time ago. That's Satoru Sayama. The shoot wrestling had already started in 1987, which was already 7 years prior to the UFC. Shoot wrestling was already in its development. And so, anyways, and then, you know, yeah, from all the professional wrestling circuits came all the professional mixed martial arts in Japan. And, you know, and then at that time, one of my best friends in the world, Eric Paulson, he was training at the Hicks and Gracie Academy. And he was in charge of the, he and Yuri Nakamura, Yurinaga Nakamura, who is the vice president of shoot wrestling. Eric Paulson put in a good word for Hickson, and he heard that there was a fight. Satoru Sayama was putting together like a big fight in Japan called the, well, at that time it was just, they didn't have a name for it yet. It eventually became known as Vale Tudo, which means anything goes in Portuguese. And
didn't know that.
Well, yeah, basically all the fighting organizations in Japan, you know, actually basically Hickson helped get their start, you know? So basically the Vale Tudo Japan was basically, you know, Hickson lent his name to that and he competed in it. And then Pride would not have even started without Hickson's help because they needed a huge name. And then, of course, Coliseum 2000, you know? So Hickson was very fundamental in the growth of mixed martial arts, those fighting organizations in Japan. So anyways, yeah, so Eric Paulson basically went to Yuri Nakamura, was like, look, dude, I've got the baddest Gracie on the planet, you know? And he should be the one fighting, you know, in Vale Tudo, Japan. And basically, Yuri Nakamura and his wife sponsored Hickson to go to Japan and compete in these events. And that's basically how that started. So while Hoist was here in the United States, you know, fighting for the UFC, Hickson was in Japan fighting, you know, for the 94 and 95 Vale Tudo Japans. You know, the 95 Vale Tudo Japan is basically, you know, the, you know, if you've seen the video Choke, that's what, you know, that was about.
Oh, how cool.
So it was a documentary. Yeah, so Hoist was fighting in the United States for the UFC. You know, you know, in this day and age, it's kind of funny because not very many people even remember Hoist Gracie, you know, because UFC is up to like 200, like 20 something now. But yeah, back in the day, if you were to mention any of the Gracie brothers' names, everybody would be like, yeah, we know Hoist Gracie. We know Hoist. The thing is with my instructor, with Hickson, he didn't get that same kind of notoriety because, of course, all of his fights were in Japan, you know? So it's kind of a shame that he never gained the kind of fame here in the United States that that Hoist had. But in Japan, though, he's basically like a living legend.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, just the amount of sheer, you know, respect that the Japanese people have for him, you know, it's... And the fact that he kind of embodies a lot of their philosophies on Bushido, you know, is kind of a bonus, too. It's kind of nice.
So, you know, it's something that they can really relate to.
Yeah, he was like a living samurai, like one of the last of his kind. Just not a lot of people. Yeah, there's not a lot of people like that anymore.
That's exactly how he feels, the last of his kind.
Yeah.
You know, I remember him having conversations with us, and it's exactly what he would say. That's, you know, when his walkout music comes from The Last of the Mohicans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's something that he's always felt like, you know, maybe not in this generation, but maybe in the generations to come, there will be another person like him. But, you know, at this moment, he feels like in the Gracie family, he truly is kind of like, you know, the last of his kind.
Mm-hmm.
He carries the weight and the legacy of the Gracie family, you know, on his shoulders.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, it's he's a very, very special human being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything with him, you know, if you ever go to his house, he's got a, you know, his library collection. He has a whole section on just nothing but Japanese philosophy. All these books on Bushido, Kakumusha,
the Book of Five Rings, and
Book of Five Rings is probably up in there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, everything to him, his approach, especially growing up in Brazil, growing up in a third world country, to him, everything is basically life or death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in order for him to, you know, when he steps in the ring, you know, that's basically, you know, life or death.
Life or death, yeah. That's one of the coolest things I think about, like, the samurai style of philosophy is they consider themselves, like, already dead, you know, so be an honor to die in battle. You know, you pray for that opponent that can they can strike you down, you know, they can best you.
Yeah, give you a worthy death.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the thing, you know, like what a lot of people didn't understand at that time, you know, because Hickson at that time, you know, he commanded pretty much like a high price mm-hmm. for his fights.
Mm-hmm.
And so that got a lot of kind of negative feedback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people assumed that he was scared to fight the top guys in Japan. And it had nothing really to do with fear. It had a lot to do with basically the circumstances that these promotions are under when you're trying to create an event, you know? Because basically, every time Hickson fought in Japan, the fights were almost 18 months in the development, so it was a constant flying back and forth to promote the events.
Mm-hmm.
And the promoters are under, like, really, like, you know, they're in a very difficult spot because they never know whether this promotion is going to go on like the UFC, if it's going to have a second, third, fourth, and fifth events, you know. So the goal for them is, how do we make all our money back?
Mm-hmm.
How do we throw an event and make as much money as possible? And, you know, because this is probably only going to be a one-time gig, you know? And mm-hmm. so the thing is, it's like, so the promoting of these events were really long. And so the promoters have to ask themselves, okay, who in Japan is a big enough name that we can put in the ring, you know, on the opposite side of the ring to Hickson, that's gonna sell this fight?
Mm-hmm.
And so at that time, the biggest guys, you know, fighting at that time, or what the Japanese people believe are fighters, are professional wrestling, professional wrestlers, because to them, they're convinced that these guys are fighters. So basically, when you're fighting somebody like Hickson, they do not really care, like, you know, the thing is, the guy who they're, because it has to do with kind of like kind of almost like a national pride, okay? Like whether you put Hickson in the ring with Bas Rutten or whoever beats Hickson, it has to be a Japanese guy.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want it to be the Bas Rutten to be the one that beats Hickson.
No.
By the way, it'll never happen. But anyways, it would never happen.
Never.
But, you know what I'm saying though? Because Bas Rutten's not going to pull that many people. You're going right. to sell, like the Tokyo Dome, you know, for Coliseum 2000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they always said, okay, there's no way. There's no way for a fight anyone's ever going to sell this out. You know, only maybe Michael Jackson or Madonna, you know, they're going to sell a 90-seat stadium.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, Hickson did it. Because you know, basically they're going to pull in the biggest name Japanese guy that they possibly have to make as much money off of this as possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and Hickson commands kind of a high price because, you know, because basically that's how he feels. He's kind of putting his life on the line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a conversation with Hickson like many, many, many years ago, you know, because when you're on the internet, surfing the internet, you come across all these cool interviews and all these cool quotes. You know, and there was this one interview with Henzo Gracie, mm-hmm. you know, and I was always a huge fan of Henzo's.
Yeah.
And Henzo was like, you know, at that time it was leading up to a fight with maybe him and Matt Hughes. And there was a lot of trash talking back and forth. And he had this quote that was basically like, you know what? When, you know, when people lay their head down on the pillow at night before they go to bed and they pray, you know, a lot of people pray for material things. A lot of people pray for a nice life. Whoa. Hey, what's up, dog? And, you know, they pray for material things, you know. And so he's like, you know, when I lay my head down on the pillow before I go to bed, I pray that when my day comes, because it comes for every man, that I'm able to take my beating like a man, mm-hmm. you know? And I was like, wow, this guy is a fucking warrior.
Yeah.
You know, pardon the language, but mm-hmm. yeah, he embodies kind of an aspect, a side to the Gracie family. Mm-hmm. And it was always like, you know, my job as a fighter is to be prepared, you know, all the time, to be in shape year round. Because that's my life. I am a fighter. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I have to be prepared because you never know. You never know when you get that call, somebody's injured, and you got to fight. It's my responsibility, whether I win or lose, to represent Gracie Jiu-Jitsu to the best of my ability and to fight, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that was cool. So I talked to Hickson about it. I was like, wow, I mean, it was so inspiring. I was like, this guy, you know, steps in the ring regardless, no matter what, against yeah. all odds. And he's out there to just, you know, put it out there. Mm-hmm. And Hickson, you know, yeah, he was like, yeah, that's kind of cool. You know, it's, you know, it's not really me, but, you know, I have a bit of respect for Henzo.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the thing is, he doesn't really feel like he's a fighter. What he does is he represents jiu-jitsu. And basically, the thing is, the way he thinks about it is like, look, man, I'm not there to step into the ring and put my life on the line and leave it up to the judges whether, you know, to take me out of the fight. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of times when he fights, there's a clause in the fight where it's like he doesn't want any rounds. The fight cannot be stopped under any circumstances by the referee. He will never allow the referee to stop the match, you know? So basically, you know, the reason why I asked the price that I ask, you know, for one, he was like, look, because a lot of people think of me in Japan as like the best. So if I set a particular price, I set the bar. And if I set this bar at a low price, then that means no other fighter in the world ever gets paid more than that. Mm-hmm. You know, so I ask and let's see what they come back with. But what I'm asking for is how much is my life worth? Because that's basically what I'm doing. I'm putting my life on the line.
Yeah.
And he's like, this is how much my life is worth because, you know, he's never going to tap. He's never going to submit. He's never going to give up. Mm-hmm. You literally, you have to kill Hickson. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the reason why he did what he did. Mm-hmm. And so in the promoters, in trying to match Hickson's price, you know, they have to throw these huge events, and so under those circumstances, yeah, you know, Japanese professional wrestlers were usually, you know, the first option because mm-hmm. they were huge.
Yeah, they were the most famous.
Yeah, but yeah, Hickson was, you know, as far as Henzo Gracie goes, he's like, no, it's, you know, I represent jiu-jitsu. I'm, you know, my thing is not win or lose. My is like, you know, it's a fight to the death mm-hmm. for me. And there's no such thing as losing.
Yeah.
So
a little bit different viewpoints between the two, but both fucking super honorable. Both and respectful,
super yeah. honorable, super badasses. Mm-hmm. But one guy is like, you know, for me, it's not a fight. It's not like, You know, it's literally, you know, he has to kill me. I'm not going to tap.
Mm-hmm.
It's never going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like the last of my kind. Mm-hmm. I'm the only one that hasn't been submitted yet, you know.
Yeah.
And he's like, he has to kill me.
Yeah, to cultivate that kind of mindset, I mean, that's like a lifetime of training mentally and physically, you know.
Yeah, it's a lifetime of training. It's a lifetime of growing up in third world countries where, you know, a lot of times when you grow up in these countries that, you know, there's a lot of poverty and your friends are poor, you love your friends to death, and the next thing you know, they're gone, you know, they die. And you realize just how fleeting kind of life is. You know, Hickson lost a lot of his friends in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And so you grow up a little different. And a lot of times, you know, especially in Brazil, growing up among the brothers, like, he was always the one to step up. You know, Hoyler would tell all these stories of, like, man, they were, you know, some kids threw a rock, you know, and hit Hoyler in the eye, and, you know, there's like a bunch of guys wanting to fight, and Hickson would run in there and, you know, fight all these guys at once, you know. He was always like the first one in there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, yeah.
Kind of a warrior lifestyle.
Yeah, basically, mm-hmm. basically. So, you know, you just kind of grow up in kind of a different mindset, different mind frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see the world through a different lens.
Yeah, you grow up. It's a very. You grow up quick there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a harder kind of life.
Yeah,
you know, you see a lot.
Absolutely. So, that was a little bit later that you paired up with Hickson, right? In your jiu-jitsu experience, you went from
training at
Lovato's to Lovato's, and from Lovato's, did you go straight to Hickson?
Actually, no. When I was in Dallas,
mm-hmm.
I was at the Dallas Art Institute. I was studying computer animation at the time.
Yeah.
My brother had already moved out to Los Angeles. My brother moved to Los Angeles at the end of the summer of 1995. So he was there during much of Hickson's training and preparation for the 95 Vale Tudo Japan.
Mm-hmm.
The Vale Tudos and a lot of the Japanese promotions, their biggest events, even the UFC is you know, their Christmas event. The Christmas show is usually one of the biggest mm-hmm. they have all year. But my brother was out there, and he ran into Carlos Machado. And Carlos Machado told him that, hey, you know, I'm moving to Dallas, and I'm about to start a jiu-jitsu school.
Yeah.
And you know, my brother said, hey, you know, my brother Matt lives in Dallas, and here's his number. And so I remember living in Dallas, and out of nowhere, I get this call in the afternoon, and, you know, Carlos Machado. Mm-hmm. He's like, hey, I just moved to Dallas. I'm opening up a jiu-jitsu school.
Hmm.
Do you want to come train? I got your number from your brother.
Yeah.
And I was like, yep. I'm there. I'm going to be the first one there.
How cool.
And I was basically Carlos Machado's first student
uh-huh.
in Dallas. And the studio was actually the Amadeus Studios,
mm-hmm.
where Chuck Norris, all the sound stages where they were filming Walker, Texas Ranger.
Wow.
Did you ever train with him?
No, I have never trained with Chuck Norris. But that man is an absolute machine. He never get, from everything that I've heard, even from Carlos Machado, is that he never gets tired.
So
this was like, you know, 25 years ago.
Funny thing, Cody's mom used to do, she was a stunt double.
Uh-huh.
So she was with Chuck Norris, like, she trained with him and everything.
Wow.
And, like, they hung out.
That's cool. I bet there's some interesting...
She obviously wasn't a stunt double for him.
Oh, no. Yeah, of course not.
She was a stunt double for females.
But that's cool.
Yeah,
I bet there's some interesting stories from that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if I remember correctly, you know, Chuck Norris and, you know, Bob Wall. Bob Wall was a good friend of Bruce Lee's. Bob mm-hmm. Wall was in... Bob Wall was in, you know, two of Bruce Lee's films, right?
Yeah.
Return of the Dragon and Enter the Dragon. Hmm. So they were in Brazil, and already in the mid-80s, they had already encountered Gracie Jiu-Jitsu.
Wow.
You know, I'm not going to call it Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, because at that time, that's basically the only schools, and I think it would be disrespectful just to give it just like an umbrella term like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe they trained with Hickson and Hoyler at that time.
Wow.
I know for sure it was Hoyler.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, Hoyler.
And we see a little bit of jiu-jitsu influence in those movies.
So. Yeah, yeah. Walker, Texas Ranger, they had a lot of episodes actually featuring the Machado brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I remember
cool.
being in
I didn't know that.
Dallas at the time, uh-huh. and Carlos was telling us, man, all my brothers flew in. We filmed a couple scenes, and yeah, it was cool. I couldn't wait for the episode to come on, recorded it back mm-hmm. in VHS tapes, and just played it over and over and over again. That was cool. It was cool.
Yeah.
So you see it in, like, 1995, I think it was John Machado already using the straight leg bars, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Unreal.
And they did it, you know, on TV. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
How cool is that?
Super cool. Because, you know, in jiu-jitsu, everything is connected.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happened was at the time, Horian Gracie was doing a lot of these huge seminars, you know, 80, 90 people, you know, renting out wow. like huge conference rooms in Dallas. And Chuck Norris was, you know, was very close kind of to Horian. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that's where he met the Machado brothers. And they developed kind of like, you know, a very tight bond. And Carlos Machado eventually became his main instructor in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And, you know, and, you know, Chuck Norris has always kind of flown that the Machado flag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's always done everything he could to help them out, and he was a big supporter of theirs.
Yeah, that's
so
really cool.
You couldn't help out a bunch of better guys. They're good, really good people.
Mm-hmm.
Carlos Machado especially. Yeah. Jacques and Hegan, those guys are cool cats.
Definitely. So we went from Lovato to Machado, and then from, what was the in-between between Machado and Hickson? Was there any schools in between there, or was it straight from there to the Hickson Academy?
You know, like I said, like all my friends from high school, we went over to Lovato's. At the time, it was known as Martial Arts International. It hadn't become like a dedicated jiu-jitsu school yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I went to, when I was living in Dallas, okay, my brother had moved out to Los Angeles. And, man, my brother would call me up like every other day, you know, and he's like, dude, you're not going to believe what just happened here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nothing but, you know, at the time, you know, they still, you know, Horian Gracie had put out, you know, the Gracie Challenge out in Los Angeles. He put it out in all the magazines and all the newspapers and all the gazettes, you know, they have out there. It was $100,000 out to anybody that could walk into the academy and beat one of the instructors. $10,000 to anybody that could walk out, that could walk in there and beat one of the students, you know?
Unreal.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is a shitload of money back
That's
then.
That's a shitload of money, yeah.
Still is, but yeah, back then, you know, that was an extra shitload.
Yeah, yeah, it's rather amazing. Mm-hmm. So, but anyways, so they would get like whole Kenpo karate schools, all these guys from Krav Maga,
mm-hmm.
got all these guys from like these Kung Fu schools and Aikido schools, all walking into the Hicks and Gracie Academy to do the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it was always the same thing. It was always like, look, guys, you guys got the wrong school. You guys got the wrong academy. You're looking for, you know, the Horian Gracie, Hoist Gracie, you know, school in Torrance. That's the Gracie Academy in Torrance. You know, our school was up in West L.A. off of Pico and Sepulveda. And, you know, and it was always the same thing. It's like, oh, what? Isn't this like the Gracie Academy? Doesn't it say Gracie? I mean, are you guys scared to fight? I mean, are you guys a bunch of pussies, you know? And it was always like, dude, you motherfuckers just fucked up right there.
Uh-oh.
You know? And they're like, dude, you just walked into the Hicks and Gracie Academy. And they were like, you know what? Fuck you guys. We're not even, don't even sign the waivers. Don't even waste your time with that. So they would break out the cameras and
hold my beer.
Yeah
basically one of those, you know. And between my brother and one of the instructors, like whether it was Luis Heredia or Jason Gregorian, they would just go through these guys, like, the entire academy, like, one at a time. I don't think I've ever seen my brother get hit in a fight before. His understanding of just how to close the distance. And no, it was cool. My brother was a white belt, blue belt at the time.
Yeah.
You know? So he was, like, you know, one of the hit men at the academy.
Unreal.
Yeah.
So it was cool.
Did you have to fight in any of those challenges? Did they say, Matt, fuck this dude up?
I never fought in any of the challenges at the school. Mm-hmm. But Luis Heredia, many years later on in the training at the academy, when there were new guys that would come on in and they kind of had kind of an attitude, he would kind of like say, Matt, you know.
Go arm lock this dude.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Matt is an arm lock specialist for you guys that don't know.
Yeah.
He'll get me in like 10 arm locks per round or something.
I get that all from the Camarillo brothers. David Camarillo.
When did they come into the picture? That was later in the jiu-jitsu career, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was in 1996. The first time I saw David Camarillo step out onto the mat. He has foot taped up. He always has his foot taped up, you know? It was always from all the Kosotogaris that he always does. You know? Yeah, he always explodes with that jumping Kosotogari and then pulls guard.
I've also seen, what was it, one of the matches that you sent me where the Camarillo brothers are rolling together, yep. And he jumps from like 2 or 3 feet away for the scissor takedown. I was like, holy shit, you almost blew your brother's knee out. Like, these guys are savages.
Yeah, they are savages.
I can't
imagine
doing that to anyone, let alone my little brother.
You saw those guys back in their day, man. They were absolutely, absolutely incredible. Not to say they aren't now, but, back then, I don't think anybody had seen really what those guys had to offer. Their incredible combination of judo and jiu-jitsu, their explosiveness, and, you know, their precision and their relentless attacks. So it was just an incredible sense of proprioception, spatial awareness, timing, anticipation, and just two brothers that just did nothing but just hunt for arm locks, combined with just incredibly, you know, beautiful movement. Mm-hmm. You know, you watch guys like Rafa Mendez today doing what he does, running around, walking through guard.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had already seen a lot of that, you know, from David Camarillo.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not really new to me. Just, you know, Rafa Mendez takes it to another level.
Yeah, he's got his own style. His own play on it.
But, yeah. So it was cool. It was almost like, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I was already watching guys like Rafa Mendez, you know, in guys like David Camarillo. You know, it was very, it was a very unique style.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I feel like those guys were so ahead of their time with their blend of judo and jiu-jitsu and the different things that they were working with, like the leg attacking and whatnot, that's just now coming back around.
Yeah.
It's kind of nuts to see how, like you said, 15 years ahead of their time, basically. Like, it's incredible.
Yeah, there was, those guys are amazing. They were a huge, huge, tremendous influence on my game.
I thought that was good, too.
Yeah. So, anyways, the first time I saw David Camarillo, it was in 1996, and he stepped out on the mat against Yuki Nakai. Mm-hmm. Yuki Nakai fought Hickson Gracie in the finals of the Valley Tudo Japan 95. And, everybody there, you know, because after watching the choke documentary, after watching the Valley Tudo 95, Yuki Nakai was basically blinded in one eye, and he's half blind in the other eye. You know,
Goodness.
Gerard Gordeaux was just, you know, sinking his thumb into his eye like the entire fight.
Good
you
Lord.
Know, it was a horrible, horrible thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Yuki Nakai was basically like the underdog, right? And so you can't help but cheer for the underdog. So basically, Camarillo was a purple belt at the time. And so he had a match. It was, I believe it's the Joel Moreira tournament in 1996. And Hickson, I believe, was there watching because he had a lot of respect for Yuki Nakai. So I think that was Hickson's first introduction to David Camarillo. And they had a match. And I believe David Camarillo won the first match off points.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember what happened. There was some kind of something happened during the match. And there was, you know. So anyways, they had a rematch
there was a discrepancy in the match. Like, there were points that was not scored or something that Yuki Nakai had earned, like passing points or cross-eye points that, you know, wasn't given to him. So they had a rematch. And then Yuki Nakai basically... You know, I really don't know Yuki Nakai. He was just like an underdog. So I pulled him aside and I was like, Yuki, against this guy with his guard, just, you know, attack his legs, go for the foot lock.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he won with a foot lock.
How cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't know at that time, you know, that how close I would eventually get to the Camarillo brothers and Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember many, many years later, we were at the Coachella Arts and Music Festival watching Rage Against the Machine open up for Tool.
Wow.
And I broke down and I started crying and I, you know, I don't know. These things you get pretty wasted at.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear to God, I apologized to him for that. I was like, I'm so, so sorry about that match.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. And then a year later, the 1997 Joe Morera tournament. And, I'll never forget this tournament. David Camarillo walks in there, and I remember one of my friends, Morgan Weiser, this is the day before the tournament, we're looking at all the brackets and stuff, and we're taking a look at the brackets of the Joe Morera tournament. We're like, ooh, you have David Camarillo first round. You know?
Jeez.
anyways, so Dave ended up literally putting on a clinic. He had completely... just played with everybody in his division at the purple belt division, and then he entered the open division.
Mm-hmm.
And he just completely smoked the entire open division.
Wow.
Doing some of the most beautiful jiu-jitsu that I'd ever seen, and Hickson was there on the mats refereeing all of the matches of the open division, so he got a really good look at Camarillo's game. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then in the finals, Dave Camarillo faced off against Garth Taylor, who outweighed him easily by, you know, 150 pounds.
Oh, my God.
And he ended up throwing, basically sweeping Garth Taylor to taking the back. And then he threw Garth Taylor, Taiyotoshi, later on in the round and went on to win the open division. I mean, he's just incredible.
Yeah.
He knows how to play the game. He knows how to win. He knows how to win on points. He knows how to submit. He has one of the most complete games I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And Hickson really took notice and, you know, walked up to him after the matches and, you know, was like, wow, you know, one of these days you come by my academy and show me your tricks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how that started.
Yeah.
And then... ever since that day, David Camarillo was always, you know, like a welcome guest at our academy. And, you know, it was awesome. It was awesome to have him there. And actually all the guys from the Half Gracie Academy, every time they came down, all the guys out of the Mountain View Academy, every time they came down, they would stay at our house. Mm-hmm. And for many, many years, it was just like, you know, like a jiu-jitsu headquarters. And as far as Dave is concerned, I've never... ever in my life seen Hickson stop the class and, you know, give somebody a private lesson. And he did that on two different occasions for Dave Camarillo.
Wow.
Who just literally just stopped the class and was like, hey, come train. It was awesome. It was
that
cool.
Is.
Yeah. I wish I got that kind of treatment.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
So it was just mad respect for Dave Camarillo.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very cool. Very cool stuff. So, Camarillo Brothers, and then you came back to Oklahoma shortly after that, right?
Yeah.
Some training at the Hickson's.
Yeah, I spent 15 years training out there, 15 years training in Los Angeles, off and on at the Hickson Gracie Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And, and then in 2010, I moved back home to Oklahoma, and I was training at Redline for a little bit, on and off and on, and on and off. That was my impression of Hickson's flow with the go.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I trained there
on and off and on for a couple of years. Yeah. And then, you know, with Taige, and then I came to, you know, Oklahoma Martial Arts Academy. Mm-hmm. That's where I met all you awesome people. Mm-hmm. It's my family right here.
Yeah, no doubt. So. That's we were lucky enough to.
We're the real winners.
Yes, exactly.
In that relationship.
Well, look at this fucking. He's gone from all these incredible people to.
I know. I almost skipped out 15 years. Like, all right. From 1996 to 2010. You know, actually, no, to 2015.
Yeah.
That's when I started training over at OMA, Oklahoma mm-hmm. Martial Arts Academy.
And that's it for the special two-part episode of Troy Trilzerian with Matt Akins. If you could please go on iTunes and give us a 5-star review to help us climb the charts. And stay tuned for Troy Trilzerian's Sponsor Spotlight.
Sponsor Spotlight.
Oklahoma Martial Arts Academy can be your home for self-defense tactics, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, mixed martial arts, boxing, Muay Thai, and much more. With classes throughout the day and week, we offer self-discipline with an accommodating schedule. For ages 3 and up, partake in classes, be a part of the team with Black Belt Professor Seth Norman and Brown Belt Janie Meadows. All in all, great people. Make the change today. We're located inside of Key Health Fitness at 14701 North Kelly Avenue in Edmond, Oklahoma. Or you can call us at 405-816-7242. See you on the mats. Oss.
Shout out to the awesome folks at Hemp Connects, my CBD sponsor out of Boulder, Colorado, run by Matt and Courtney Chandler. Awesome people with a vision for health and wellness. A few of the products that I use every day are the tincture oil, ranging from 500 to 1,000 milligrams of full spectrum CBD. You just apply a few drops under the tongue and you're ready to go. I like to do it at the beginning of my day and at the end of my day to help sleep and to help mood as well as inflammation and things like that. Another option are the chill pills, which come in a pack of 30, 25 milligram active CBD capsules. Awesome if the oil is not your thing. So those are really good as well. Also, I like the Agape Body Spray, which is a topical rub that is hemp infused with 500 milligrams of CBD, really good for localized pain. So check them out at hempconnects.com/jiu-jitsu. Awesome people with a great cause. Thank you.
All right, everybody, here we go. 1, 2, 3. My name is Dr. Jeff Ajazi. I'm a practicing chiropractor in Edmond, Oklahoma. I've been practicing for a little over 8 years. My practice is at 3560 South Boulevard, Suite 100. Come check us out. We're here to take care of you.
We just wanted to plug Green Strength real quick. The founder of Green Strength, Lucius Christopher Tyree, did I say that right?
The fourth.
Any nutritional or strength and conditioning needs, he is the physical culturist around here. So be sure to hit him up, pick his brain, follow him on all of his social media stuff. He shares dope shit all the time.
You guys can find me on Instagram. It's GreenStrengthIV, as in GreenStrength4. And then my website is GreenStrengthHQ.com. And you can find me there. You can reach out if you ever have any questions or anything. And holler at me.
So, yeah, that's a wrap.